I think this radio station, in fact, I know this radio station going back to, I don't know, President Roosevelt, maybe. I mean, really, literally that far back, has interviewed presidents, just about every president anyway, and every vice president, has interviewed any entertainer that's been through Chicago. Dean interviews, what, 10 of them on his show, just like that, on his A-list. But this is a topic, I don't think, with all the years this radio station has been around, I don't believe there's ever been an interview on this topic. The name of the book, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects, Superfly. Sounds like a superhero. In some ways, flies are that, according to the author Jonathan Balcombe. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to talk to you, and I guess I start here. Why did you decide to write a book? How did you decide to write a book about flies? And you were very kind. You included mosquitoes as well.
Yeah, mosquitoes are definitely flies, and that's part of why I wanted to write a book.
Whoa. You know, we don't have the best connection with you, Jonathan. Are you there? Uh-oh. Is he gone?
My cheek must have hit the mute button.
Okay, let's try it again. So why flies and mosquitoes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, mosquitoes are flies, and there's very few people on Earth who haven't had direct experiences with flies, including mosquitoes. And so because it's so, they're so personally there, they're so present, they're so omnipresent, it struck me as a good subject. And there's really good science on flies. There's a huge diversity of them. They're really, really important. They are crucial pollinators, food web members, and they're also important cleaner-uppers of messes and bad-smelling things. So, you know, they're really important on Earth, and everybody has experiences, often bad experiences, but there's a lot to learn about them.
Well, let's talk about some of the good experiences first. As far as pollinators go, they are responsible for pollinating much more than you would think, I believe.
Absolutely, yeah. Flies rank second to the famous bees for pollination. And in cooler areas, such as high alpine areas and the Arctic areas, they are the number one pollinators by far. And when you consider that 90% of the world's flowering plants are pollinated by insects, you know, over 100 of the most important crops that we have are pollinated by flies,
mm-hmm.
and to the value of about over half a trillion dollars a year, if you want to put a dollar figure on it.
Well, and it's fruits, some very important ones to us, including, this is not in the fruit food group, but a very important food group, chocolate.
Yeah, it turns out the cocoa plant is extremely hard to pollinate those flowers that it produces. And there's only one known insect that actually can and does do that, and it's a tiny midge. It's popularly known as the chocolate midge. And most of the flowers, even if they're pollinated, do not produce cocoa pods. But no flower will produce a cocoa pod unless it's found and pollinated by this tiny little midge, which is a very, very unspectacular-looking fly, but with a very spectacular role to play in the ecology of ecosystems.
Tell me about the honeymoon flies. At least clean it up so we could talk about it on the radio.
Well, writing about animal sex is always entertaining, and flies do not disappoint. Their sex for them comes in 50 shades of brown. And the honeymoon fly may be kind of related to, I think it's the love bug. It's the same species, renowned for mating for long periods. You know, I think it's 50 hours or so is their record. And they're able to fly together while they're in tandem. And one theory as to why these flies may mate for long periods is, from the male's perspective, it's a good way of ensuring that he's the only one who mates with a female and no other male gets access, because he's there. He's in the way. He's literally a physical blockade for another fly. And there's quite a lot of animals around the world at different levels, vertebrates, invertebrates, that use that strategy.
How long did you say they are in the – are they in the air when they're doing this?
They can fly while they're mating. I don't remember the exact number. I think it's many tens of hours. It may be about 50 hours. It's not the record. The record for continuous copulation by an insect, I think by any animal, is, I think it's 50, it's 70 days or so for a stick insect.
For a what? We lost them. We'll never know. We'll never know who took 70 days to do their business.
This thing keeps going mute. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what. Let me
hold it away from my head.
That's okay. Let me. What insect was it that does this, first of all?
A phasmid or a stick insect.
All right. Yeah, they kind of look like sticks. And yes. If they look like sticks, they're not moving very much anyway. And I guess they don't when they do what they need to do. And this is kind of otherworldly, the name of the book, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Superfly, Jonathan Balcombe, the author, is here. Hey, Jonathan, why is it that when I take out that fly swatter and I go, shoo, and I might be pretty quick, but the flies are usually faster?
Yeah, they're remarkably fast. They pick up on movement. They've got good vision, and they also pick up on air movement. But also, they have an attention span. Careful studies show that flies are very alert, and they're visually oriented animals, most of them. And they have mechanisms that react to an approaching fly swatter or something similar before the fly even thinks about it. But once the fly is aware of it, the fly is that much more attentive.
So I have a personal question for you. In the book, it has some images, and you know, like lots of books do, in the center of the book, and it shows a couple of flies, stable flies, and the caption is, a stable fly in Ontario, just before and just after, filling up on the author's blood. Are you crazy?
Well, we've pretty much all had the experience unwittingly of having our blood stolen by biting flies. Stable flies look a lot like house flies, and they're devilishly fast. They're even faster than house flies. And, yeah, as part curiosity and part research for the book, I decided for a change to actually allow a stable fly and also a horse fly to complete a bite because I was curious to see what the whole process was like. I never let them bite me normally because it hurts and you don't like our blood being stolen. And it was really interesting to see how incredibly full this fly would get, how they tank up. I mean, mosquitoes are renowned for gaining about 3 times their weight while they fill up. And they actually urinate to concentrate the blood so they get rid of water while they're biting. Hmm. If you watch closely, and maybe some curious people out there will actually try this. But that stable fly was really bloated by the time he or she finished biting me.
Now, was that in your contract? So I've written books, and I've not had that in my contract that you must. So paragraph 4, number 5C, author must also get bitten by mosquitoes and flies. And that could be dangerous, really. I'm just kidding about that part. But mosquitoes and flies do carry disease, do they not?
Yeah, that's a serious side of things. You know, where I live and where I think you're in Chicago area, you know, that those areas are pretty free of diseases, although climate change is causing a geographic spread in the areas of risk for things like, you know, yellow fever, malaria, of course, dengue, leishmaniasis, encephalitis. It's a pretty long list. I mean, only about 1% of all 160,000 known species of flies is harmful to us. But yeah, those ones who are, and mosquitoes are the most common vectors, are very serious in the tropics. I mean, the number of malaria cases, the rate is ongoing at about the same rate as COVID. COVID may be something that comes in and largely goes, but malaria has been with us for centuries.
Well, and that's part of the problem, too, because you point out overall resistance to pesticides has risen 61% between 2000 and 2010. And you have some numbers, some other data about that, too. It seems every time we find a way to control these guys find a way to one-up us.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. I mean, insects, because they have such short generation spans, they're evolutionarily very nimble. They adapt. Bed nets, for instance, treated with pesticides have been very successful in the tropics. But now, you know, people sleep at night, and now mosquitoes are shifting their daily schedules to the daytime. So it's an example of how relatively quickly they can change their behavior to get around some kind of defense. And as for pesticides, as you quite rightly mentioned, resistance is a very serious problem. We tend to stick with a pesticide, and then before you know it, insects are adapting to those pesticides. There's strong selection pressure for that to happen. Also, pesticides are disconcerting because they often harm so many other animals, including animals that eat insects. They concentrate the pesticides from all the insects they eat, and so you have birds and fishes and some mammals who can really be in trouble from that. So one of my recommendations is that we move away from pesticide use and use instead integrated pest management and bed nets and those sorts of strategies.
All right, so I want to talk about those sorts of strategies. What do you mean by integrative pest management?
Yeah, that's using combinations of various methods so I'll give you an example, the sterile male technique. This is a program, this is an approach where you use genetic manipulation. So you've got GMO flies that are being bred in huge numbers in labs. And when I say huge numbers, I mean over 1.5 trillion sterile males have been released over the course of 40 or so years of the Moscomed program, which is a joint program of the United States and Mexico since 1979. And so we're talking huge numbers. And the whole idea is that these sterile males go out there and they have to outnumber natural, non-sterile males, normal males, by a lot to be effective. And the idea is that they mate with females and the females don't produce offspring from that, from those matings, and that the sterile males take up the space, if you like, from the normal virile males.
Mm-hmm. How important is it, though, that we do things like solve the problem of a fungus in a fruit bat in America that's killing, I don't know, millions and millions of bats, and also consider the animals that eat naturally? They're the best form of pesticide, I mean, the control that there is, I would imagine, because this is what they do.
It's a great point you make there. I mean, you know, ecosystems are, and animals are interdependent. And when you mess around with one important level of a food chain or a food web, and flies, because of their new numbers, huge numbers, are very important, both as consumers, but also as sources of food for large numbers of animals. Well, when you do that, you mess up the other levels of the ecosystem, and that's very problematic. And yes, the white nose syndrome.
Yes, thank you.
That is really harming a lot of bat populations, and they are important feeders of insects. I used to study bats, and I used to watch over a million bats fly out of a single cave in Texas to go and feed on mostly migrating moths high up in the sky.
Yeah, I've seen that too in Texas, and it's an amazing sight to see. But when you think that what you see today in 2021 isn't anything like it was even 10 years ago, it's kind of scary.
That's
on
right.
a number of different levels, and it means more mosquitoes out there. Now, having said all that, when there's a mosquito going zzz, buzzing around you, do you do what we all do? Be honest. Do you go, crush?
Depends on my mood. It depends on how far into my hike I am, or you know, exploring nature, which I do a lot of. I tend to give them a second chance for the first little bit, but if it's very clear and they're mobbing me, absolutely, I resort to lethal methods. My rule of thumb is if they're out to get my blood, then they're fair game. And you know, there's quite a few different kinds of flies that do that, and they have different strategies. And I have to say, some of them are pretty. Not, I mean, mosquitoes are pretty tricky and quick to an evasive often, but there's some flies that are very not so. They're just, you can literally just reach down and pick them up in your fingers.
What are the noceums that, as they are called, the sand flies? They're not, they do fit under the category of what you write about, I believe.
Absolutely. The noceums, the sand flies, also called punkies. They've got some different names. There's a wonderful photograph in another book on flies that I have of a punky biting the neck of the back of a crane fly, which is what looks like a giant mosquito. They're totally harmless. They don't bite us. But these flies will plug into the wings of dragonflies, for instance. They're that tiny. They're known for biting, and there are actually some specimens preserved in amber that's tens of millions of years old.
Wow!
These flies were almost certainly biting dinosaurs. Unfortunately, dinosaur blood and DNA breaks down after maximum of a million years, so the DNA in there unfortunately can't be used to create dinosaurs the way it was done in Jurassic Park.
That's right. That's right. So that is, so don't believe everything you see in a movie, but friends, do believe everything you read in Jonathan Balcombe's book called Superfly. If you're interested in nature, it definitely is a fascinating read. I'm scratching already, sir. I'm itching just talking to you. But that's an adverse effect, I believe, out of doing this interview. Maybe the first interview ever on this topic on WGN. So I thank you for that, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Steve.